People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A Victoria doctor who works with vulnerable populations is tackling myths online. Have a listen.
What does someone who is unhoused and sleeping outside do all day? I'm Dr. Jill. I'm a street doctor, and I've worked with people who are homeless for the past 15 years. Now, I've never been homeless myself, so I am not a true expert in this, but I have seen what my patients do all day. And I'm tired of hearing them being called lazy, because when you're homeless, you simply don't have that luxury. So first off, people have to figure out what to do with their stuff all day. Are they going to leave it where it is and risk bylaw officers coming and throwing it all away? Do they wait until a friend is there to watch it for them? Or maybe it's been raining for 4 days and they need to leave everything out to dry. Or perhaps it's about to rain and they need to cover it all up. Or are they just going to pack everything up and bring it with them all day? Then they need to start walking and walking and walking. They need to find a toilet and a place to wash up. Maybe somewhere they can do some laundry. They need to get to soup kitchens for a hot meal, a food bank. Maybe they need to pick up some specific items. They need to meet with their outreach workers, get to a pharmacy for their daily medication, perhaps meet with a social worker and have a visit with their kids who are in foster care. They may need to check their email, and without a phone, they need to get to a public library to use a computer. Or if they do have a phone, they need to find a place to charge it. They have appointments with parole officers, with welfare workers, with housing workers. And oh yeah, did I mention that being homeless is really bad for your health? They need to find a place for safe medical care and then try to follow up with what's recommended. Do they need blood work? Do they need x-rays? Do they need to see a specialist urgently? They may not be able to access medication unless they have valid ID, and ID is a whole other issue. It's a constant struggle when your personal items are always being stolen. So maybe they need to find an ID clinic where someone can help them with that. And all this walking, it's usually happening with very poor footwear, often not suited for the weather. And although not all people who are homeless have addictions, for those who do, they generally spend a lot of their time throughout the day figuring out how to stay out of withdrawal.
That's part of a video that has more than 200,000 likes on Instagram. It's from Street Dr. Jill, aka Dr. Jill Wycherock. She's been practicing street medicine for 15 years. In December, she started posting short videos on different topics related to homelessness and healthcare. Since then, she's racked up more than 100,000 followers across multiple platforms. She's hoping to educate and influence public opinion with the ultimate goal of improving policy and improving outcomes for vulnerable populations.
I'm Dr. Jill Wycherock. I am an inner city doctor, an addiction specialist, and an emergency doctor on the island.
And on Instagram, you have close to 75,000 followers. But I would like to begin by maybe talking a bit about your work offline. You work as a street medicine doctor. Can you tell me what that is and what that looks like in practice?
Yeah, so I mean, street medicine, it is another way of saying that would be outreach medicine. So I have been an outreach doctor for my entire career. So that is essentially providing care to people who have a lot of barriers to accessing care. When you're homeless, and whether you're living in a shelter, whether you're living outside, whether you're couch surfing, it can be really hard to access healthcare for a whole lot of reasons. And street medicine or outreach medicine brings that care to where you are so that people have an easier time accessing care and can get past some of those barriers.
So what does it actually look like on the day-to-day? How do you go out? Who do you go out with? How do you find people? How do you connect with people so that they become your patients in the first place?
Yeah, so I mean, here in Victoria, I work with an inner city community health center that is fantastic, and it is a group of healthcare providers that are all dedicated to providing care in this way. And I work with some skilled and compassionate nurses on a van, and we park that van. The days that I'm with them, we are parked outside of a shelter twice a week. And people come to us that are living in that shelter. People come to us who are living outside that shelter on the streets. And
Other people come to us from other parks in the city, from other places. Outreach workers will often bring people to us on the van on that day, on those 2 days that we're there. So, that's one modality. Other times I'm working with another organization providing healthcare to people who are pregnant and have substance use disorders. And I might be doing outreach in supportive housing. I might be doing outreach to someone who is living on the streets, providing health care on a bench, in a park, in a tent. So it can look like a lot of different things depending on the day.
And what are some of the more common things that you're helping people deal with?
Well, I mean, keeping in mind that when people are chronically homeless, their life expectancy is about 30 years less than the national average. So, people's health is very poor at baseline. Being homeless is very, very bad for your health. So, the kind of things that I see on an everyday basis are, of course, a lot of mental health issues. I mean, the majority of people have dealt with significant trauma in childhood and throughout their lives. Not everyone, but the majority. And this has led to a lot of mental health struggles. There are addiction issues. Not everyone who is homeless has addiction issues, but many of them do. And that complicates healthcare in all sorts of other ways as well. But helping people with their addictions is a big part of our work. And then there are a lot of infections that people have, whether it is from, maybe secondary to drug use, or maybe it's just due to living in conditions that are make them extra vulnerable to infections. And there's a lot of chronic illnesses that are poorly treated. I mean, when you have diabetes or high blood pressure or heart disease, it's hard to just get regular care so people's disease process is often more advanced than it might be in someone that's housed. I see people coming sometimes with very advanced cancers that they have kind of been ignoring for sometimes a long time, because remember, people have a lot of competing priorities. I mean, when you're trying to figure out, am I, where am I going to get my food today? And where am I going to put my head down in a safe place tonight? Then when you have priorities like that every day, healthcare just gets put lower and lower on the list. So there's those are some issues. A lot of respiratory issues. Well, there's respiratory issues. There are a lot of foot care issues. People who are on their feet all day with poor footwear. Some in winter, sometimes they can't even take their boots off and dry off their feet, and they can get infections from that, and of course frostbite. And a lot of people have acquired brain injuries who are living on the streets, and that's kind of an invisible thing that people don't always see or recognize, but is always underlying everything. So I mean, I could go on. Honestly, I teach learners for an hour on what healthcare issues people that are homeless face, but I won't do that here.
Well, just listening to you share all of that, I'm wondering about like the issue of kind of supply and demand for street medicine for helping people through some of these things.
And supply and demand. So, I mean, I guess, well, sadly, I don't see myself being out of work anytime soon. There are a lot of people experiencing homelessness who, and it's only increasing in our communities because of so many failed social policies by our governments, really. So there are a lot of people. Again, remember, not everyone is lining up for healthcare, because again, even when it's right in front of you, even when the healthcare is right there, when those barriers have been decreased, there are still a lot of people that just they're just too focused on so many other things in their lives. There are, when you are unhoused, you just have so much going on, and you're trying to juggle so many things just to get to the next step forward. And again, healthcare often falls to the bottom of that list. So yes, although we are rarely quiet. Like it's usually very busy in our clinics. I think there could always there's always room for more people providing this type of care for sure.
Now, if I understand it right, you've been working in this field of medicine for 15 years or so. And recently, you have started posting these short videos that I think it's fair to say have kind of blown up on social media, where you talk about different topics related to your work and related to homelessness. I'm wondering if you'd take me through the decision to start posting those videos and what maybe it was like at the beginning making some of the first ones.
Yeah, well, it definitely is the most uncomfortable thing I have ever done as a physician. But I work with Doctors for Safer Drug Policy, and we are an advocacy group based out of Vancouver Island. And we had a fantastic communication strategist speak to us, Jodi Patterson. And she's based in Victoria, and she has a long history of being an activist in this area. And she spoke to us about how we can do a better job communicating our issues. I mean, we've spoken to politicians, we speak to health minister, politicians at different levels of government. And she said, you know, the politicians simply are not listening to experts. They're not listening to research. They are not listening to evidence. They are listening to public opinion. And if we want to make a difference, maybe it's time to start chipping away at public opinion. So, I mean, I really certainly we do know that politicians have been very frankly ignoring evidence and research. And I thought, well, I went home and I discussed it with my husband. He's actually a retired mental health worker in the community for over 25 years, doing mental health work, often with the same communities that I work with. So he has a lot of knowledge. And I said, the social media thing, I mean, I wasn't even on Instagram before we started this. I said, I don't think I could do this on my own, but if you wanted to partner with me, maybe we could do this together. And he agreed. And so it is a joint venture between my husband, who prefers to remain the silent partner in all of this, and myself. And actually, now between Facebook and Instagram, we do have over 110,000 followers. I should also note that the small short videos are uploaded on YouTube as well, and we're really happy for anyone to use them, to download them, to use them for teaching, that sort of thing. Yeah.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. My guest is Dr. Jill Wycherock. She's based in Victoria. We're speaking about her work as a social media influencer on topics around homelessness and health. You talk about public opinion, you talk about evidence there. What are some of the big goals? How do you choose your topics, and what are the things you're trying to communicate with people?
Well, I mean, it has not been hard choosing topics. Let me tell you, there's still a long list of things that we haven't had a chance to tackle yet that we think are also very important. But again, having done this work for 15 years, you realize there's just so many misconceptions that the public has about people that are homeless. You know, I think there's kind of a common thing out there. You know, people drive past an encampment and they see people living there, and they often mistakenly blame those people who are living there, right? They blame the individual for living in their park, for living on a street, for, you know, but really what people need to understand is that this is the blame lies with very poor policies for years by our governments, and an unwillingness to make courageous decisions in to change policy, to change direction. Because a lot of times these things aren't going to change within a 4-year cycle. So politicians are reluctant to make those changes. So one of the biggest things is how do I help people understand that this is not a personal failure issue? You know, being unhoused is not a personal failure issue. It is, we need to be upset with our governments and for allowing this to happen. And so when I frame everything that way, you know, I remember a patient of mine years ago, who came out of hospital. He had been treated very poorly and he was highly stigmatized. Again, when I talk about barriers of care for people who are unhoused, I mean, they will access healthcare in different settings and be stigmatized wherever they go, be treated very poorly, again, blamed for living in poverty, for being in the situation they're in. And that makes them really reluctant to even go to a hospital or to go to a health clinic. And my patient many years ago, this encountered the same thing when he went to an emergency department. And he came back and he told me, he said, you know, if those people just knew what I have been through in my life, they would never treat me that way. And that just, you know, I always think about that when I'm making these reels. How do I help people understand what some of my patients have been through so that they can maybe start to see the human a little bit more?
And so, how did you go about doing that? If you were to take me back to maybe you're making your first reel, or say the first one that really escaped containment, if you will, what was that like? How did you kind of script it, and what ended up as the result?
Yeah, so you know, my husband and I sat down and we made a just a list right off the top of our head of just a whole bunch of topics that would be important for us to cover throughout this series. And then we started honing down on what are maybe the top ones that we want to start with. And we spend about a week working on a script, really thinking about what are the most Well, the biggest misconceptions that people have, and the ones that are the most damaging, and how can we, what is a really good way of helping reframe this for people? And, you know, my husband is especially important in this because as a doctor, I see, I'm sometimes seeing things through that lens, and he is able to remind me, wait a second, you're not speaking to medical students or residents or other doctors, right? Let's just, you know, keep things very accessible. And so that's very helpful. So we're always thinking about, so yeah, his input from that is very helpful because he's bringing that kind of layperson's input. And I mean, I also have colleagues for many years that I've worked with, and sometimes I reach out to them and say, do you think this is an important one? And they'll be like, oh my gosh, yes, but what about this? You know, so that's how we've been doing it. And we try to you know, my husband does all the videoing and we try to kind of average about one a week.
And when did you see that this was something that was picking up traction and was generating a lot of engagement on the platforms?
Yeah, well, again, I didn't have anything to compare with because, you know, I was not even on social media in any meaningful way prior to this. I often, you know, joke that most of my time, most of my interaction with social media was telling my kids to get off of it. So there were, yeah, actually really early on, I think it was like within the first, actually even the first video, I couldn't believe I was just looking at it the next morning. I was like, is that a mistake? Like, how many times has that been viewed? You know, it was all very surprising. And I think it's, you know, this whole algorithm business, I think it's just a lot of kind of luck of who reposted certain things. But I started to get messages from around the world. I mean, there's a lot of direct messages that I get, but there's also a lot of just comments on the reels and stuff. You know, we're hearing from people with lived experience who are saying, wow, I feel seen. Thank you so much for helping people understand this. They don't get it. And that is really meaningful. And we're also, you know, there's a lot of people saying, wow, thanks so much. You know, I've always wanted people to talk up like this. I totally agree. You know, and those kind of comments are not as meaningful to us. I mean, maybe it's nice to get them, but if that's all we got, we would have stopped this long ago. But then there's a whole lot of folks who are saying, you're making me see things a bit differently. I hadn't thought of that before. Wow, thank you for reframing this for me. I understand it more now, and I can. You're humanizing folks for me, and I see addiction in a different light now, and stuff like that. And that is really very meaningful for us. And that makes this feel like it's important work.
On that front, in past interviews, you've touched on a framing of the idea of drug addiction as not something where people are seeking drugs as a way to get high, but ultimately they're seeking drugs to avoid the terrible symptoms of withdrawal from them. I'm wondering if you could tell me more about that idea and that framing.
Yeah, well, when people have a severe addiction, ultimately, I mean, when I'm thinking, I mean, there's different classes of drugs have different withdrawal syndromes and stuff. But in, for example, if we're talking about opioids, my patients, when they have severe addictions, they are always telling me they're not getting high anymore. They're just trying to feel normal every day. They just want to wake up and not feel sick. And that is what, I mean, that's part of what addiction is having these withdrawal symptoms of having your tolerance go higher and higher. And then just needing to use just to stave off withdrawal symptoms. And we're lucky with opioid use that there are medications that can help that quite effectively. And that's good. You know, there was one follower from Australia who reached out to me. She is raising her niece because her sister has an opioid use disorder, an addiction, and is not able to parent her. And this woman said, you know, I lost compassion for my sister. I was angry at her. I just felt like it was her fault. She needed to make the choice to stop. And she said that my reels have helped her reframe how she saw addiction, and it made a whole paradigm shift for her, and it gave her her sister back. So, you know, she was able to have more compassion for her sister and repair their relationship and then support her sister in a different way. And that was, you know, that it's not uncommon that we're getting messages like that. And that feels really important.
Over the last year, maybe 2 years, a number of people have talked about a backlash against harm reduction. In a lot of your videos, you touch on a lot of harm reduction concepts. I'm wondering if you could tell me, do you feel like we're in the midst of a backlash against harm reduction? And if so, what is it like doing the work that you are doing in that context?
Well, it feels all the more important because I fully feel that we are in this backlash right now, like you mentioned. And, you know, it's shocking because, again, if, you know, harm reduction has saved thousands and thousands of lives across this country, just by seeing, for example, how many lives are saved in supervised consumption sites. I mean, that alone is an indicator that thousands of people have been saved by harm reduction, not to mention all the other health risks that are reduced with harm reduction. However, yet despite this, you have politicians saying that, oh, we're going to go in a different direction. We need, you know, and they're putting more money now into abstinence-based treatment programs. Now, abstinence-based treatment programs are also important, and it's not an either or. It is a both. They are both really important to fund and to champion. Harm reduction, I, you know, as an addiction doctor, I realized over the last few years that people have this idea that harm reduction is not part of treatment. And I've always scratched my head about that. I'm like, well, of course it is. Harm reduction is the first way that you engage with people and you're treating someone from the moment you're first interacting with them. And it's often in a harm reduction model that you're doing that. So I really don't understand. I guess I do, because so when communities see people who are using drugs on the streets, I do want to point out that the most people who are dying of opioid overdoses are housed and live in their own places. They are most of them have jobs and also have addictions and are, or even sometimes just experimenting with drugs, and they are becoming, you know, victims of this horrific crisis. But people who don't have four walls around them are the ones that are more visible to everyday, folks in the community. And again, people feel anger that they don't want to be seeing this on their streets, that they don't want to be, they get feel anger towards the individual instead of feeling anger towards the systems that have allowed that to happen. So when you see a supervised consumption site, a harm reduction site, and you see a whole bunch of people outside, what you need to think of is, wow, we need more of these. There needs to be more. There is more demand than there is supply. We need to increase harm reduction in our communities. It is unconscionable that there's this backlash towards harm reduction when all the evidence shows that it is an integral piece to the puzzle.
You're listening to People First Radio. My guest is Dr. Jill Wycherock. She works with vulnerable populations in Victoria. She also has a social media presence under the handle Street Dr. Jill. She has more than 100,000 followers across different platforms. She shares short videos about different aspects of her work. Here's an example.
What is the fentanyl fold? I'm Dr. Jill, and I'm an addiction medicine doctor. Now, I've heard these terms used recently, fentanyl fold, fentfold, fentbend, to describe the position someone might find themselves in after using street fentanyl. When they're bent over at the waist, their head is at the level of their knees, and they might be in that position for an hour or longer. Now, there are no good studies out there that are actually telling us why this happens, but we do have some ideas. Now, street fentanyl affects the central nervous system, and it can make you have decreased muscle control and decreased motor control, and that can make you floppy. Now, why someone would be floppy on the top but not on the bottom is something we don't understand. Street fentanyl also decreases your level of consciousness so that you don't react to that signal that says, hey, it's time to stand up. This is awkward. We also know that there are many contaminants in the street drug supply that are toxic to the nerves that make the muscles work. This is part of the picture as well. Now, street fentanyl accumulates in the body's fat tissue, and it can stay around for a long time. So someone who actually uses chronically multiple times throughout the day to stay out of withdrawal, they might not be able to stand up at all straight until they've had it out of their system for a long time. This is not something we saw in addiction medicine even 3 or 4 years ago. It is a direct result of the contaminated street drug supply. Now, I have seen people recently making fun of people in this position. I have seen kids do it. I have seen adults do it. I have seen video games with characters mocking this position and so many social media posts. Please don't be that guy. And don't be that guy that doesn't say something when someone else does it. Remember that every single person who uses fentanyl is someone's mother, someone's son, someone's daughter, someone's cousin. They are loved and they are suffering. And making fun of human suffering is just cruel. So just be kind. See you soon.
Now back to my conversation with Dr. Jill Wycherock. Ultimately, what are you hoping to achieve through these reels and this shift you're hoping to create in public opinion?
You know, every reel that we make, before we even start it, I ask myself, how is this going to improve the lives of my patients? And if it doesn't, if it's not doing that in some way, then we're not going to do it. So it's from having someone walk down the street and look someone who's homeless in the eye and say hello and treat them like a human. That is making a difference to that person right there. All the way up to, hey, what would I like to see? I would like to see a massive wave of public opinion shift towards compassion for people who are homeless, compassion for people with addictions, to get rid of the stigma that is crippling my patients and all the care they receive and all the policies that governments make or don't make based on stigma. So that is what I would ultimately like to see, is a huge public opinion shift. But an important difference for me is someone who can, maybe when you're driving down and you see an encampment and you feel anger about an encampment, and then the next day you see that it's all gone, maybe instead of feeling happy that that encampment is gone, maybe people will think, where did they all go? And maybe those people will realize that The risk of death is much higher now that those people have been displaced. That the harms that are coming to those people because they were displaced are actually very significant. These are things that people don't know. And I have to feel that, as humans, we are built to be compassionate and caring for each other. And with education, I hope that that's what we can always remember.
There are a lot of sort of overlapping pieces to parts or elements of living homeless that have come up in our conversation so far. You've talked a little bit about encampments. We've talked a little bit about substance use and addiction. I'm wondering if you could talk to me about maybe starting with, say, the intersection between homelessness and drug use. You've mentioned so far that, not everyone who is homeless uses drugs, but it is a common thing. What do you think it's important for people to know about kind of the overlap, but the fact that they are also distinct?
Yeah, well, I remind people that there is stigma that comes with being homeless, right? Oftentimes you don't have a shower for many weeks. You know you're disheveled, you're not well groomed. You're living outside. There's stigma that comes with that. And then there's stigma that comes to having addictions, and people see that wherever they go. There's stigma. And so then you have that compounding stigma, that intersectionality, like you mentioned. And then a lot of my patients work in the sex trade, another layer of stigma. A lot of my patients have spent time in the criminal justice system or coming out of jail, another layer of stigma. Not to mention Indigenous people, racialized groups, all these layers of stigma that can add up. Some part of the LGBTQ and trans community, another layer of stigma. So sometimes you have people who are homeless who have five layers. They belong to five groups that are highly stigmatized. That just makes everything so much harder for them to move forward in life, for them to access the care they need. So, I mean, it's rare that people just are homelessness and addictions are the only two stigmatized categories they're part of. Many times it's many more than that. So the intersectionality is a big piece. And when people have addictions, I mean, it is harder to get out of homelessness. And when you are homeless, it is harder to recover from addictions. Right? So they compound each other. They both of them, it's kind of like, again, and when you have addictions, you're more likely to become homeless. And when you're homeless without addictions, you're more likely to develop addictions just as a way of coping with everyday life. So there's kind of this bi-directional thing that's going on between homelessness and addictions as well.
What do you think people should do with recognizing that there's a layer of stigma that comes with homelessness? There's a layer of stigma that comes with substance use. There's a layer of stigma that comes with an involvement with the criminal justice system. Like, if we recognize all of those things as having their own kind of distinct layer of stigma, what do you think comes with that recognition? What do you think we do about that?
Yeah, and that's, there's so many things that could be done. I mean, one is educating ourselves and recognizing that we should all be learning about these issues to especially when you work in certain parts of the community, you just really want to be well educated on these things. So you recognize that in yourself when you're having some feelings or thoughts on things. But also our government could do a much, much better job at public education campaigns. They wring their hands and say, well, people don't want this, and that's all because of stigma, right? But if they actually said, well, why don't we start trying to change public opinion? If they actually did that, if the government went on the kind of campaign that I'm doing right now, let's face it, they have a much bigger reach than I do. But if they actually decided we want to decrease stigma, we are going to work on decreasing stigma in our communities for all these marginalized individuals, they could very successfully put together campaigns that would effectively do so. And That's again, I don't think that fits in their 4-year plan, sadly, but
Well, what you just said is maybe one answer to this question, but I wanted to make sure to ask. So you've been talking about the idea of influencing public opinion as one of the key things that you're trying to do, because you've suggested that public opinion seems to be what is driving the way we respond to issues like homelessness. What do you see as the way that like we recognize what the public opinion is, or how public opinion manifests itself or makes itself clear to politicians? Particularly, I'm thinking like perhaps the people who are the loudest voices are the ones with the strongest opinions on certain subjects. How do you feel like if there is a shift in public opinion, like we'll even know?
well, I hope those people are going to be loud. That's what I want. I am hoping that as people's opinion shifts, maybe people are, those loud voices of negativity towards my patients need to be countered by loud voices of that speak for compassion and human rights and that's what I'm hoping for, is that those folks, will start writing the same, even more letters to the editor, and write, speak up even more to their politicians, saying, "I want you to care for the people in our community who need it the most." We're done turning our back on these folks and actively harming them. We need to do better as a society. So I hope that that's what comes of this, right? Like when elections are coming down the road, I am hoping that more people vote compassionately.
Are there any of your reels that you feel particularly strongly about that you feel like are best representative of what you're trying to do, or you feel like have really seemed to stand out in the response they've gotten from people?
Well, I mean, when I think politically, there is one called Sadness and Rage in BC. And this was a reel that I posted on the week of the 10th year of the public health emergency declared in BC of the toxic drug crisis. And in that one, I do speak to some of these issues and my frustrations with successive governments that have rolled back on ways that can solve this crisis. So there is that one. I mean, again, the reels, there is one that speaks specifically to stigma. And I think stigma, I often say that stigma kills more of my patients than any health condition, and I'll stand by that. Because I have patients that are treated so poorly when they go into the community, when they go into a healthcare center, that they look me deep in the eyes and they say, "I would rather die than go back to the hospital and be treated the way I was just treated." And I've had patients that have indeed died because they absolutely refused to go to the hospital when they needed it. And that is not at all uncommon. If stigma, again, if we could work on decreasing stigma and just treating everyone as humans without the judgment, a lot of things would change.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. I'm speaking with Dr. Jill Wycherock, who is a Victoria-based street medicine doctor. We're talking about her work on social media under the handle Street Dr. Jill. So you're doing this work of street medicine on the ground, boots on the ground. If you were to zoom out to a 10,000-foot level and you were in charge of redesigning some systems, what kind of changes or investments would you be making?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, I'm not purporting to be the expert in that. I am an expert in health. And what I get angry about is when, people who are not experts are saying, "No, like harm reduction doesn't work." I'm like, "Well, you're not an expert in harm reduction, that's for sure. You're not a health expert, so don't pretend to be." You have politicians telling doctors how to do medicine, and so I get angry at that. So I'm not an expert in that. But honestly, what there are some very common things. People need a universal basic income. Poverty, if we just gave people enough money to live on, a lot of issues would be taken care of. We need more supportive housing for people. We need to be able to get people homes. So it's not about more shelter spaces. It's about more homes for people with the supports wrapped around that can help people stay in housing. And we need a lot more mental health and addiction supports for people as well.
How do you see that one of poverty play out on the front lines as a street medicine doctor? Like when you're talking about the difference, say something like a basic income would make, how do you see that when you're working with patients who are homeless?
Well, I'll tell you right now that there are good studies out there that show, lo and behold, when you give someone who's homeless money, they can get themselves out of homelessness, right? Shocking, eh? You give someone who's poor money and they do better. You know, this is we know this. So there was a study in I think it was Vancouver who where there were no strings attached. People who were chronically homeless were given a set amount of money. I can't remember how many thousands of dollars it was in the 1 year period, and the vast majority of them were housed a year later. There was another study out of Seattle, I think it was, with youth, the same thing. They were given money, homeless youth were given money. They were given some extra supports as well to help with that money. And they all, just about all of them, were housed within a year. So, I mean, it's no surprise. And as far as poverty goes, you know, poverty is really bad for your health, not just homelessness. When people are poor, they don't live as long. They don't get, their health is worse at baseline. So when you give people more money, their health is going to improve. You know, a big part of what I do is I do disability applications for people. So people who are on income assistance or welfare, and re they're receiving a ton, just, you know, no one can live on the amount of money they're receiving every month. And they do have disabilities, and I fill in an disability application for them, and their income is just about doubled. Well, you know, then people are telling me, wow, I ate meat for the first time in, you know, years when they could actually afford to buy healthy, some good protein. So yeah, getting it's no shock that when you have more money, you have better health.
I believe the study you're referencing there from UBC, it was from Jiayang Zhao, a professor there at the time. We spoke about that study on the program about 2 years ago. If I recall, the results were exactly as you say. One caveat was they weren't able to include anyone who had any kind of a substance use issue in their sample. They couldn't get ethics approval to do that.
You know, I mean, people, the other thing that people don't understand, I talk about how this is a compassionate approach, how this is a human rights approach. But guess what? It is also very cost effective for our society to be getting people out of poverty, to be getting people off the streets, to be getting people out of shelters and into housing. It is ex it's such a waste of money. Homelessness is extraordinarily expensive for a society. And when you get people housed, again, their health goes up. So they're not as, you know, they're not as sick. They don't have as many healthcare issues that are going to require, you know, taxpayers' dollars. They are also not going to be eating, they're not going to be accessing the shelters, which are taxpayer dollars. Like there's so many, you know, harm reduction is shown very effectively to be extremely cost effective. And again, that's for a whole lot of reasons, but it is, you know, if people can't be swayed by the fact that compassion and human rights and just common decency to our fellow humans is important, I would hope that they could be swayed by the fact that it is just a lot more economically sound for us to house people instead of to be sweeping away their belongings, taking down their tents and throwing them out every week. And I mean, you get where I'm going with this, right?
You've been doing this work for 15 years. In that time, we have seen the cost of housing in Canada explode, particularly a significant jump from about 6 years or so. Is that something that you see filter its way into the work you do? Like, are you able to draw a line between the extreme cost of housing and how that influences your work as a doctor working with people who are homeless?
Oh yeah, it was shortly after COVID or maybe during COVID where I was starting to see people that were homeless for the first time ever in their mid-70s getting rent evicted from places. And there's a whole new layer of homelessness of people that have never been homeless before, that were just always precariously housed, and things fell apart in the last 5 years, and now they're living in a shelter and have never been in that environment before. And there are so many people that are in that situation. So yeah, it's I definitely see that.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today about your work as an influencer or working in street medicine or anything related to what we've been talking about?
Well, I guess I am a little bit surprised at the reach that this social media campaign has had. And it reminds me that it was important for me to step out of my comfort zone and do this work. And I think that maybe if more people did that, if more people with that privilege, with the capability to do something like this, if more people were to do it, imagine how loud that voice would be. And so that would sure be nice.
Well, Dr. Jill, thank you very much for coming and talking about that work with me today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Joe.
Dr. Jill Wycherock is a street medicine doctor in Victoria. On social media, she goes by the handle Street Dr. Jill. We were speaking about her work as an influencer, posting short educational videos on topics related to homelessness and health.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
A team at the University of Saskatchewan is letting people know that dogs can overdose too. They say that just like in humans, naloxone can save lives.
My name is Mary Ellen Gibson. I am currently a PhD candidate at the University of Saskatchewan in the Department of Sociology. I research substance use and harm reduction, and I also work with the Positive Connections Lab, which here in Saskatoon works on looking at the human-animal bond and how we can mutually benefit each other's lives.
And you and a few colleagues recently wrote in The Conversation about dogs, overdose, and naloxone. Could you tell me a little bit about what prompted you to do that?
Yeah, this has been a really interesting project where we have been seeing an increase in opioid-related overdoses across Canada for a number of years now. And it really prompted us to think about other members of our family who might be at risk and how we could respond in those situations. So we have public health researchers, veterinary researchers, as well as sociology researchers coming together to start a conversation around how we can better support our canine companions in the midst of an opioid overdose crisis. So we came together, looked at what available research there is out there, and of course, talked to veterinarians to learn better how we can respond if there were an incident where one of our canine family members happened to get into opioids, accidentally eat, ingest, or even smell opioids through their nose and experience an overdose. And we learned that naloxone, the opioid reversal drug that we use for humans, can also be used for our dog companions as well.
When you were looking into this, can you give me a sense of how often this might be happening?
It's definitely not a huge, huge concern. So everyone who's walking their dogs out in public doesn't have to be overly worried or incredibly cautious around this. But it is something that we are seeing that is happening in our Canadian communities. It's a very small percentage of situations that are emergencies for our dogs, but it is still something to be aware of. So we see in certain, especially urban environments where people may be walking their dogs and there may be discarded paraphernalia, or even dogs can accidentally get into medications in our own homes. And we know that 1 in 10 homes in Canada has an opioid prescription. So being aware that if we do have opioids in our home, or sometimes our dogs are even prescribed opioids, if they've gone through something like a surgery or had an accident, being aware that an overdose is possible for dogs and that naloxone can be used to reverse it is our first step. So it's definitely nothing to be panicked about, but it is something to be aware of.
Could you tell me about maybe the mechanism that can cause an overdose in dogs?
Sure. So a lot of the research that is out there is actually around law enforcement working dogs. So because dogs surveil the world and explore the world with their noses, they may come in contact with remnants of unregulated substances, so through something like policing, or they may, you know, again, smell something that they shouldn't that may have a little bit of opioid on it. Because their noses are so strong and because it's what we call a mucous membrane, the ingestion of an opioid through their nose can actually be enough to potentially cause that overdose. And in dogs, same as humans, an overdose is what happens when we have so much opioid in our system that we can't process it properly. And that can lead to the opioid slowing down our central nervous system, actually to the point of slowing down our breathing, to the point that we stop breathing. So that's really the situation where we want to be able to respond.
And if that were to happen, how would you know? What would it look like in a dog?
Sure. So for a dog, it's actually somewhat similar to humans, looking very lethargic, being almost unresponsive, being really low, not moving in a way that you would expect, not having their typical energy that you know that they would have. They might have pinpoint pupils, similar breathing patterns to in humans. So really slow breathing or no breathing at all, or having a really real difficulty in bringing their breath to a normal rate.
So if that happens, what is the response that your work suggested people should take?
So we suggest that if this were to happen and you believe that an opioid has been ingested, of course, seek medical attention as soon as possible. But if you have naloxone with you, you can actually administer naloxone nasally. So we have a nasal spray of naloxone. You can do that in the snout of a dog. Or you can also use the intramuscular injection of naloxone into large muscle groups of your dog. So we have some resources on our site that can show you what that looks like and also a video. But into those large muscle groups, usually around their hind leg, is the safest bet. And you can inject that in. If you feel comfortable doing so, you can even provide some mouth-to-mouth resuscitation with your dog. But we always say to be very careful around this. Use a barrier if possible, just in case they do have opioids on their nose or mouth that could influence you as well.
Is it safe to use naloxone in a dog?
As far as we see in the research evidence, naloxone is safe to generally use on dogs if they're experiencing an opioid overdose. Generally speaking, it's not going to cause harm if there's some other medical situation going on, same as dogs and humans. But it is important for if an opioid has been ingested, naloxone can have life-saving time to allow breathing to reoccur within that animal very quickly. So it can be very helpful. This is also the substance that veterinarians do use in medical settings. So if they were to suspect an opioid overdose in a dog that did come to them, they would be administering naloxone in that veterinary setting as well. So this is a standard veterinary practice. So even though naloxone isn't commonly used or commonly known for dogs, this is considered off-label use. It can be used in emergency service situations with your dog.
Is there any important difference people should know about when this situation happens in dogs versus when it happens in people?
That's a really good question. I think the big thing is to just be very aware of their noses. And because they're more likely to have ingested the opioids through their nose and having it kind of on the surface of their bodies, is if you have something like a towel nearby or piece of clothing to watch for, if that dog revives, they may sneeze. And that sneeze may actually have remnants of that opioid on it. So being very careful if you are deciding to provide mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to have a barrier of some sort or to have towel or clothing nearby so that you can try and prevent any cross-contamination of that opioid when your dog is revived. So that's really one of the main concerns that could be a potential. It's a low potential, but it is still there. So we do like to caution people on that.
Dogs can be all sorts of different shapes and all sorts of different sizes. How does that relate to this or factor into the response to a potential overdose?
Really great question. Regardless, we always say ensure that you get that veterinary care as soon as possible if you suspect that overdose or if you've administered naloxone. But the amazing thing about naloxone is, regardless of the animal size, just like us in humans, the dosage that we have right now is safe for anyone, any size, any background.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation or let people know about this issue of dogs overdose and naloxone?
I think one of the biggest things and what's most important for me is just recognizing that dogs are a member of our family. They can have some of the same medical concerns that we do, and they can have some of the same medications that we do. So having these tools in place to take care of ourselves and these members of our families is so important to ensure that we're all just able to get through some of the medical concerns that we're seeing in our community and in our homes right now. So this is just such an important and simple tool to have with you to respond to an opioid overdose in your dogs, but also in our human community as well.
Mary Ellen Gibson, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mary Ellen Gibson is a PhD candidate at the University of Saskatchewan who works with the school's Positive Connections Lab. We were speaking about dogs and overdose. That's all the time we have for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you very much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.